Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And today we're talking about opening restaurants. Everyone's excited about new restaurants, right, Cindy?
Definitely.
Well, guess what? There are people that are like fighting to stay alive on the other side.
It's true. Yep.
You know, we've been through some openings for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And later in the program, right before you suffer through a chef's challenge, we'll talk about a little bit of our own experience. We have two terrific guests before that.
Very excited.
In the second segment, we have Irene Stein from Alma Cocina Latina, a Venezuelan restaurant here in town.
Mm-hmm.
And a very special guest, Gordon Ramsay, international restaurateur, owner of, I think it's 16 Michelin stars, restaurants all over the place. I recall eating in his three-star Michelin restaurant in London.
Yeah, yes.
Back in 2002. Of course, a TV star from Hell's Kitchen. And he's opening a restaurant in the Horseshoe Casino here in Baltimore, Gordon Ramsay Steak. It's exciting to talk to him. Hey, how are you?
Thank you. Hi, Tony. Hi, Cindy.
How are you, Gordon?
I'm very well indeed. Thank you. So excited to be here.
Thank you for joining us.
Pleased to have you on. I think the person most excited to talk to you is Chef Cindy.
Yes, I am excited. I'm glad you're with us.
Thank you, darling. I'm very happy to be here and obviously excited ahead of our opening here at the Horseshoe.
All the best luck to you. I hope it goes really, really well and may all the food come out perfectly, which is just always exciting.
Behind every chef is a great team, and I depend on that heavily. So, customers vote with their feet. And I think for me, the most important thing is getting consistent. I'm really happy with the food and then spending quality time with the team.
Great. So, Chef, I have a question for you. You have an incredible background. I'm so excited to talk to you about some of your experiences from the beginning of your career when you,
right.
I mean, you worked for Joël Robuchon, one of the best chefs in the world, Guy Savoy. I bet it was exciting to work with Marco Pierre White. Can you tell me some of the experiences you had or maybe even what you just gained from those experiences back in the beginning of your career?
Of course. There's no fast track to success. I think we all know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the bigger the apprentice ship that you put in, the longer your career spans out. So, I was, excited to start working with Marco Pierre White to begin with. Spent 3 years with him before wanting to go to France. I needed to understand how to finesse,
mm-hmm.
And Marco showed me an amazing way of putting food on a plate, almost like an artist. From there, my dream was to go to France, and he suggested rather than going straight to France, go and work for an amazing French chef, which I did, Albert Roux, at Le Gavroche, and it was London's only 3 Michelin star establishment at that time. So that gave me the sort of inroads to the sort of modern sort of French haute cuisine, and then gave me a great insight to how tough it was going to be in France. Albert then set me up with Guy Savoy in Paris. And that was, for me, one of the most exciting kitchens I've ever been in because it was French cuisine with that incredible lightness. And it was something that nobody was doing in London. So it was all very heavy and rich and gorgeous and delicious. But the minute I got to Paris, Guy Savoy had this incredible sort of light flair with, such great combinations. I remember making the first spider crab risotto finished with mascarpone cheese and grated white truffle. And it was just, mind-blowing. I'd never put mascarpone cheese with white truffle. So he sort of lifted the barriers of the stigma attached to French cuisine. And then I wanted to go to one of the greatest kitchens anywhere in the world, and that was at Le Jamin under Joël Robuchon. And for me, I spent 12 months there under his tutelage, and listen, like any great chef, they're firm, they're fair,
sure.
But the knowledge you are receiving, not by day, by week, by month, by the hour, was invaluable. So, it was, a mission. Once you work for one great chef, the secret is not to stay at that hierarchy, position. The important part, Cindy, for me, was to get down to the sort of floor and get back behind the line rather than get into a number two position and then start mastering the craft of each and every individual talented chef you work for. So it's almost like going back to the shop floor, starting all over again with each and every chef. And that's what I did, really, rather than look for a bigger position with more money, more comfort, less hours. I wanted to start at the bottom. I did that in 5 big kitchens, and that was the base of my I suppose, my training.
Right. That's an incredible foundation. I mean, that's a dream come true for me. The thought of getting to work with one of those chefs would be incredible. That's an amazing foundation upon which you built for your career. You also have 16 Michelin stars. I mean, as a chef, my greatest dream is to have one Michelin star. Tell me how you felt when you received your first stars.
Yeah, I remember it like it was yesterday, Cindy. The Michelin Guide came out. As I won my first star, Marco had won his third star. And so it was in 1995, back in Chelsea in London. And I was so excited because, you know, I opened up this little neighborhood restaurant. And it was, almost like winning a sort of an Oscar.
Exactly.
It was just incredible because it was, you know, the prestige of being given that star. And that kind of kudos to the restaurant. And let's not forget, these guys, they came to visit you and inspect you incognito. So they could have been any customer.
Sure.
So that goes to show how consistent those restaurants are. And, you know, everybody thinks that they're spotted and you can tell an inspector from a mile away. No way. Nowhere near it. So it's a big celebration. Of course, once you've got one, you want to get determined and hungry for two. And once you've got your second star, how do you become a three-star? Well, you have to become the best two-star in the country and rival existing three stars with your own magic. But I brought something back to London that was different. And so, you know, it was 1 to 3 stars in 6 years, and that was bloody quick. But
that's amazing.
I had something magical, something different, and something super creative that I suppose in many ways I had, you know, one of the best restaurants in London with all the accolades and half the price of the top restaurants. And that's what I suppose helped me get there.
Very good. Congratulations.
So I'm curious. I'm sure that you remember vividly opening that restaurant. What was the biggest surprise for you compared to what you expected in opening the first place?
I had to convince my wife, Tana, to sell our house, our first house, to gain the deposit in order to give security to the bank, in order to get a loan.
Well, that's big.
So, it was tough. She wasn't keen on that. You know what it's like when you get your first home, your first daughter arrives, and all of a sudden, you think you're on the way to, you know, starting, you know, the family dream.
Sure.
However, I had no security, I had no equity, and the bank sort of laughed at me. So I had to come up with £250,000 to put down as a deposit for a £2 million loan. And on the 1st of September 1998, I opened up Restaurant Gordon Ramsay in Chelsea. So, you know, it was a lot of risk, a lot of jeopardy, a lot of pressure, but listen, there's no one anywhere in the world, whether you're a footballer for the Ravens or, you know, you're the captain of the American soccer team, you need to sacrifice to get to the top. You need to be slightly selfish. You need to be slightly determined more than everybody else in that pack.
Right,
and you need to have vision. So it wasn't an easy convincing in order to get Tart to support that kind of jeopardy. You look back now, you think it does feel like, you know, 6 weeks ago, as opposed to 20 years.
I understand that.
And so how many things do you have going on now, and how many different places, and how in the world did you get to Baltimore?
Good question, really. yeah, there's sort of 3 lives. I break it down to 8-hour days times 3. So I maximize the full 24 hours a day. So 32 restaurants globally. Baltimore is a big one for me, and the relationship with Caesars goes back 6 years ago when I was given a chance to open up my very first steakhouse. And then from there, having sort of mastered the insight to a great steakhouse, I've been obsessed with burgers, like every chef loves a burger. So I made this incredible blend and put this incredible burger together and basted it. And I say basted it, I mean literally doused this thing in Devonshire butter. Explained to Caesars, I've got this incredible, exciting idea for a Gordon Ramsay burger.
Wow.
We found a site on the strip at Planet Hollywood, and 2 years later, we opened up Gordon Ramsay Burger. So we're running around 2,000 guests a day, and we've just gone over our 2 millionth burger in 3 years. So that's how the relationship started with Caesars, and it's been, you know, success after success, and they've been amazing partners. When I sneaked into Baltimore when I was in Washington 2 years ago, I saw the sites. I realized there's an opportunity. We went back. We created a concept to sort of I suppose, localize the steakhouse that we opened up in Vegas and replicate it here. There's been much work gone on behind the scenes developing. And as always, I'd never push that button until we're ready. And I can confirm today with Chef Samantha, Chef Christina Wilson, we are ready.
Great.
That's great. So what do you drink with a burger?
What do I drink with a burger?
Yeah, not everyone who has three-star Michelin restaurants confesses to wanting to eat burgers, and I appreciate that because I take special personal pride in that.
Yes.
No. Yeah, I mean, also, you know, I keep fit, Tony, so I'm allowed to eat a burger. So, you know, I run and I train, and I train for those burgers, and I need to stay in shape.
Burger training.
The chefs don't sit down and eat dinner before we cook dinner, so we crave. So a burger for us is an amazing treat. But what would I have with my burger right now? I'd have a beer. You know, Innocent Gun has been one of the most amazing beers. And I you see that based on the success at Burger in Vegas.
Chef, can I ask you how you would describe your personal philosophy towards cooking at this time in your life?
Personal? Yeah. I mean, it's a tough one, that one, because it's, for me, it's all about the ingredients. The better the ingredients, the little that needs doing to those. And then I suppose that level of vision with that level of creativity and you know, customers vote with their feet. Let's get that right. And the opportunity today is far wider than ever before. And so we need to stay in front of not just our competitors, but in front of our customers. And so anytime a new tapas bar or fine dining or Italian restaurants, anywhere in the world, my team are there. And even on the back of a bad experience, there's so much to learn. Whether it's in the outskirts of Barcelona or in the middle of Chicago, in terms of development, R&D, we're there. And that's really important to stay, you know, in front of the competition.
How have you gone about finding purveyors here in Baltimore? I'm curious.
Let's be honest, one of the best companies in the world for the dry-aged beef and sourcing, you know, a lot of products. We work closely with a lot of the fisheries in terms of the bass. I know it's big on the menu in terms of striped bass, and then the crab. Mm-hmm. And crab, you know, and any shellfish is important. So it's very difficult to keep it seasonal based on the demand and the sort of success for the menu. We try to sort of localize it in a way that we customize those ingredients with what's happening locally.
Mm-hmm. Are you working with any of our local farmers? Have you met?
Yes, we are.
Good. Yeah,
Samantha, we're hopefully going to meet a few later.
Oh, good.
And that's important, where any artisan business can be associated with any chef locally.
Absolutely.
It's just taking those blinkers off and supporting the locals.
Right.
And that's important.
We've been working with local farmers for a long time. If you if you need a heads up on anybody, we're happy to tell you some of the people we're working with. I'd love to share that with you because we work with some really outstanding people. This is... for me as a chef, it is one of the greatest places I've ever worked when it comes to local farming. Very fortunate.
Great.
Well, Chef, it was a great honor and pleasure to have you on.
Absolutely.
And very, very good luck with the opening.
Yes, we wish
appreciate
you the best. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tony.
Thank you, Chef.
Bye.
Well, Cindy, were you excited to talk to Gordon
Ramsay? Gosh, that was so cool. His background is incredible. I mean, he's just an incredible chef, and what an honor that he... took the time out of his, I'm sure, extremely busy day talking about what it's like to open a restaurant to speak with us. And I'm super excited that he's here in Baltimore. Proud of that.
That's really cool.
It is. Yeah, that was fun.
So when we come back on Formidable Phone Food and Wine, we have Arena Stein from Alma in the next segment talking about opening here a couple of years ago for Alma Cocina Latina and her experience. In the last segment, we'll talk a little bit about our own experience doing openings. And Chef Cindy Wolf will suffer under Chef's Challenge yet again.
I don't think so, Tony.
All of that on more on Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we have, as a follow-up to Gordon Ramsay, we have a local restaurateur, Irene Stein, from Alma Cocina Latina, a Venezuelan restaurant here in town.
Thank you very much for having me with you today.
So we're talking about openings. I had the feeling that you would have had a unique experience doing an opening because I know restaurants are not your original background. You want to tell people what your background is and how in the world it is that you've decided to open a restaurant?
Yes. Well, first of all, I am crazy. Like everybody that opens a restaurant, you have to have that talent to be a little bit insane. But my background
yes.
in food started. First, I'm an anthropologist, so I love people. I love societies. I love human interaction, and I love dialogue. I started in the food world in 2002 with catering and two cafes at Hopkins, one of them with the NASA building, where we are, in the present Hubble Telescope Institute. And it's been a lot of fun. It's been 13 years. And what prompted me to open a restaurant was actually the original idea was to have a very small space with arepas, because every time we serve Venezuelan food here, people really got excited.
Can you slow down
yes?
1 second and tell people what arepas are, because they may not all know.
Absolutely. So I am Venezuelan, and the arepas are our daily bread. We eat arepas morning, lunch, afternoon, dinner, 4 a.m. after a whole night of partying, and at 6 a.m. if you're going home when the sun rises.
That's a lot of bread.
Love it. Love it.
But this is really, I mean, it's amazing. You can have it at any time of the day. And they are crispy corn patties that are, put on a griddle till they're golden. And then you put them in the oven, if you'd like, and then they puff up. So they have a crispy outside. And then inside you open them and you fill them with whatever you want, anything. And the flavor of the arepa goes well with any kind of food, or also food from other cultures, which is very interesting. So it's a very universal way to have bread that is made of corn. And so it's gluten-free, and it fits for any kind of eating. So it's a very, very popular item. So whenever I served arepas here, there was this, excitement all the time. So I thought, well, let me open a little arepa bar in Baltimore. We started the arepas here. Nobody knew about them. But it didn't quite work out, and the owner of that location where we were going to be offered me this much bigger space downtown Baltimore in Canton, and I was a little bit nervous at the beginning because it implied that not only we were going to serve arepas, but also we would have to have a full restaurant. And the idea still, was in my heart to do a Venezuelan restaurant. So that was a very risky business in a city like Baltimore. And so it was risky, but I really wanted to do it, especially after I met the chef that is actually our executive chef, Enrique Limardo, who came with an extraordinary talent from Venezuela and to open Alma Cocina Latina with me. That's how it all started.
Tell us about your biggest surprises. What were the things that came up that, because your background is as an anthropologist, and
that's unbelievable.
You did have a catering background. Well, what came up in an opening a full restaurant that you did not expect?
Oh, my goodness. I had heard that restaurants are 24/7 type of operation. You have to have your heart in it in order to make it work no matter what. I soon experienced that actually opening a restaurant is like giving birth to a little monster. And at the beginning,
That's a very good way to phrase it.
Well, I get that.
So, mm-hmm.
As we have several monsters.
It screams, for whatever it needs, and it's incessant because it seems that it's a child that always needs something 24 hours. And then, you go to finally the crawling stages. But the monster just keeps on growing, and it really requires your attention all the time. So I jokingly call it our monster, that we feed all the time, our demanding monster. Because the challenges are so huge. The challenges is how to make it work, as you know, more than anyone, how difficult it is to make profit margins in a restaurant. And my goodness, I didn't know it was going to be this exercise. It's almost like an acrobatics exercise in your mind every day, to make sure that the restaurant develops and grows in a healthy way and so forth. So there were very difficult surprises that we have tried ever since to solve and to change and transform, to keep up going. So
wait till you have a teenager.
But at least, it speaks, and so we can argue, and that's already something.
Yeah, but so, the no listening is the hard part.
The no listening is the hard part. Oh, yes, and we've had together that conversation before. So it was difficult, particularly also because it's a Venezuelan restaurant, so we have a strong bicultural presence in the restaurant. The front of the house is strongly American. The back of the house is very Latin. We have many Venezuelan people as well, whose it's the first experience in a kitchen abroad. And so the requirements of the kitchen here or in Venezuela are, in a way, very different in the way it's administered, especially at this level, you know. And so that was a very strong challenge for everyone trying to learn from each other and how to understand each other, because the pressures of this industry are huge. And so, of course, it's very easy to point fingers. It's very easy to misinterpret the other person that's looking at you in the eye in a different way. So there was a lot of learning before creating unity among the staff. And without unity, you know that these vessels, they fall. So
it's always a battle.
When anthropology was a very useful thing, you see?
That's great.
Because we had to do that a lot, that exercise every day.
Did you have any problem finding the products that you needed in this area, since you're... cooking is from Venezuela?
No, actually, this is a marvelous privilege of the United States, is that you find, you know, pretty much everything you need. We have worked with some of the farmers to grow things that are essential to our cooking. For example, ají dulce. Ají dulce is a very sweet pepper that has a tint of heat in it, but it's very, very strongly present in the Caribbean. So not just in Venezuela, but you see a little bit through the Caribbean islands as well and how it's used. And we couldn't get it. Of course, we couldn't get tons of it from Venezuela because it's impossible to import right now over here from my country, unfortunately. And so we had a local farm, a one-straw farm, has been planting this ají for us for the last 4 years. The last year, it was such a big crop that she brought it to market where I was to pick it up every Saturday, and other chefs became enamored with the ají dulce, and now she can even sell all that crop without Alma Cocina even requesting any ají, because we overbought the week before. So it's a way to contribute, you know, our culture contributing to the city and using, like, having people use ají dulce that was unfamiliar to them. And that was a very exciting, you know, a very exciting thing to join the community that way.
That's great.
That's been interesting to find it that way. And I also bring things every time I go to see my mother. I bring things from Venezuela and things from the Amazon, for example, that, you know, we work directly with a person that works with the Piaroa community of Indians in the Amazon, and they are the gatherers of the fruit and that we use for a lot of our desserts and some of our sauces, and then they process them in Puerto Ayacucho, which is the city closest to the Amazon. Then they bring them by bus to Caracas. Then I bring them in a suitcase all the way to Baltimore. So this is when all the specialty things that we use are brought in from Venezuela directly in a suitcase. Directly in the suitcase, just like the old days. You know, we feel like explorers. And when you look at the map on the road that these seeds, or this copoazú in particular, we use Amazonian cacao that just comes from that area, the copoazú. So the itinerary of the copoazú to get to Alma Cocina Tina is extraordinary on how many people handle these bags in order to get them to us. And then I bring them on to Baltimore. And I bring them on their, you know, they put it in a vacuum seal, which is allowed to bring in. And so I declare them as jam, because they could possibly be jam. And that's how it comes in.
Declare them as Christmas presents. Yeah.
And last time I brought lemon ants as well from Venezuela.
Lemon what?
Very interesting. Lemon ants. We have a little ants from the Amazon too, and their butt has the flavor of lemon, and we use that in some of our cooking.
Wow.
The Alma. And the same other ants that are actually like red ants, they have in their butt a spicy, like very hot, hot, spicy and hot flavor to it that is used in chocolate or in sauces as well. So that I bring as well. Last time I brought all this was dehydrated this time, and even I was given from the indigenous people to try dehydrated termites, which we promise not to serve for now unless we tell you so that it is that you're eating dehydrated termites.
Well, that would be a big surprise.
I'd like to know, and I also would appreciate you not mixing up the ants that I'm going to eat.
I promise you that any ant that you'll eat, you'll know ahead of time.
Oh, I can't wait.
So speaking of these kinds of things.
Oh, my golly.
So what were you convinced when you opened would be a big hit on your menu, you know, and just failed? Mm. And what did you think you're going to do it, just take a flyer on it, and became a mainstay item for you?
That's an interesting question. I think that we predicted that the arepas would be a strong hit because you can eat them, you know, you can come in the middle of the week, have an arepa, have a cocktail, and go. But the main problem we had from the beginning, which is not a problem, it was a beautiful subject matter of conversation and culinary conversation, was that we wanted in our restaurant to have street food like arepas all the way to very high-end entrees. And we have been serving this combination from the beginning. But eventually, it's a very hard to keep a kitchen with all these specialties like that. It's extremely expensive operation. And so, you know, people didn't know exactly how to define our restaurant, whether it was a high-end a restaurant or it was a simply, you know, street food. Many people saw it differently. So we became very much a destination restaurant because of the location as well, and also a place to celebrate. A lot of people come to Alma to celebrate. And we've tried very much to develop that in the community, that you just come in, you can have an arepa and go as well. That's been more of a challenge. I think our biggest challenge has been, more than anything, the population density in Baltimore. And seeing how there's more and more, maybe I'm ahead of myself, ahead of the dialogue that we're having right now. But one of the biggest challenges has been this population density, while so many restaurants open in the city of Baltimore. And every time another one opens, a piece of the pie gets smaller and smaller. So for small independent restaurants, this becomes a very big difficulty, you know, to sustain operations. And I would say that that has been our biggest suffering and our biggest obstacle in a city, you know, this small.
Yeah, we promise we understand. one of the things I recall having a conversation with a journalist about opening and how people are attracted to new restaurants. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, everyone gets an 18-month chance. And if you're good, then you'll be fine because you will have sustained regular customers and you'll grow.
Yeah.
Slowly, but you'll grow. If you can't hold their attention for more than 18 months, then you're in trouble. But yeah, you're right. There's so many openings in our market.
It's too hard for a city like this. And that's been, it's been very hard. And you find yourself then in this mode through social media, you know, trying to give meaning for people to come out for restaurants. Because I think the other difficulty that we're facing in the recent months, on top of all these new restaurants that keep on taking away, is also this notion. I think a lot of millennials are now eating, you know, very easy food or ordering a lot of food, for the convenience of home, and then don't realize the cultural experience that it is to go to a restaurant, enjoy different ethnicities of what they're eating, but also in an environment that inspires them, in an environment that nurtures people. That culture is not instilled anymore. People are less and less willing to go out unless there's a special occasion or with friends. And so it's missed, you know, that culture or that whole experience of coming to a place to eat and having dialogue around the food together more often than just once in a while on the weekend, et cetera. I think it's dangerous for our culture to lose that. And ordering in really allows people to stay more and more at home. And so that also is a factor that affects restaurants quite a bit, I think.
I think that you're right, and I do think that there is that change in the culture where people experience their social lives electronically as opposed to feeling, you don't feel community electronically, I don't think.
Exactly.
Because you're not in the presence of other humans.
One
of the reasons that restaurants can be very comforting to people, that people, they go there to be restored by definition.
Exactly.
Is because there are a lot of humans there and you're all eating and drinking kind of together. And
yes.
And that feels good. That people should try that sometimes.
at Alma, for example, you enter Alma and the music, the cocktail, the environment that we designed and the food all go together as an experience where you walk in and you feel that you're transported in another place. And that those are nurturing. You know, during the week, it's like a rich experience. And I think that, there's not enough focus on the rich experience that we should make sure and we make an effort to have them in our life, not just once in a while, but regularly. And so anyway, we push a lot on social media the notion of culture and Venezuelan food at Alma, because I feel that's the only way we can express, you know, an invitation for something special. So, it's changed our dialogue, and we've discussed this a lot with the chefs and us on how we're really selling culture, but how important that is and how enriching that is to come. So that's where we are on that path.
You said that really beautifully, and I'm very thankful you said it, because I hope everybody listens to what you just said, Irena, because that was extremely important, and I appreciate what you just said.
I really mean it with all my heart. I really mean it.
Of course. Oh.
So you found what we know to be the truth, that the opening never actually ends.
No, yes.
It never ends. You walk through the door every day, and it's you're starting all over.
Exactly.
You're from the ground up every day.
Well, it's also the exciting part of what we do.
Very much so.
It can be a little taxing.
We should have drinks more often, the three of us, you know, because yes. The more we exchange notes, the more comforted we are. You know,
absolutely.
Because otherwise we feel we're alone and isolated in this phenomenon, and we're not. And so,
good point.
So funny. What am I doing? What am I doing wrong? We're always thinking.
You're doing what you said in the beginning, which is something crazy, opening a restaurant. Well, we thank you for coming on the program.
Yes, thank you so
much.
It
was nice to have some local context and someone so eloquent about what our experience is going through an opening.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
No, thank you tremendously for this, both of you. Thank you. It was such a nice time to spend some time with you on the phone talking about food and restaurants. I hope to see you soon.
Thanks, Irena.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. When we come back on Formidable Phone Food and Wine, before Cindy suffers through the chef's challenge that she's going to have to deal with, whether she wants to or not, We'll talk a little bit about our own opening experiences. All of that and more on Formidable Phone Food and Wine. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy, I'm curious for you, what are your biggest memories about early openings for you in your career? I mean, hearing all the other stories, that's been our topic, is opening restaurants and what it's like to go through all that.
Well, I'll never forget opening Georgia Brown in Washington because, you know, the company that owned the restaurant had an idea to do a Southern restaurant, but I came up with a food concept for them. So I had suggested specifically, you know, low country cooking. And so I had to do the development for the menu and really enjoyed doing it and did a tremendous amount of research, having lived in Charleston and you know, working in that area and getting to know people from the area, but still needed to do a lot of reading. And coming up with that food concept was a blast, but implementing it was unbelievably hard. Training, because we did so much business when we opened. You and I opened that restaurant together, and we did so much business to open to doing, you know, 165 people at lunch was just kind of nuts. I mean, or did we do more than that, Tony?
A lot more than that.
A lot more than that. No, we sat 165 people.
Right.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
We would do like, what, 300 or something at lunch?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, to open and do that kind of volume was just insane. I mean, I had to train every single, train like one new cook. It's another thing to train every single person in the kitchen, the dishwashers, the sous chef, all the sous chefs, the line cooks, the people doing the prep. I mean, it was just this, but I was young. I mean, I was totally physically up to it, mentally up to it, and it was a great experience, but it was really, really hard work.
Yeah, no, opening is definitely a teaching job.
I
was going to be a teacher when I was a kid. I always thought I was going to be a history teacher and a football coach.
Sure.
But instead, you know, teach all things about the business and all the engineering of how to get things done and the behaviors that have to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And implementing systems, it's kind of an interesting to get food to flow out of the kitchen, to get people to behave in a consistent fashion, to make sure that expectations are met consistently.
It's just a tremendous amount of knowledge
about
for George everyone.
Thinking about George Brown's opening is the first time we worked together.
Right.
That was a lot. And it was nice to be really young and super idealistic about how things had to happen. I think sometimes, I know for me, that was kind of the way to emotionally survive the onslaught of all the stuff that you had to do.
Well, and you figure, as a chef, not only did I have to teach my staff, but then I had to teach the waiters the information about the menu. You had to teach them, obviously, everything else. But I'm like, oh, God, you know, and you and I are both very organized people. And I think that's pretty much key to getting through it. But, you know, I have a lot of checklists and sheets for everybody. And you have to have finalized recipes, you know. That is the biggest thing, to be able to hand a cook a piece of paper that has a recipe on it, but I still have to teach them. I mean, I can't just hand it to them and say, here, go. But, you know, I can say, hey, do the mise en place, which is all the ingredients that it takes to set up the recipe, put the recipe ingredients together, and I'll come by when you're done, tell me when you're done, and then I'll help you get it executed. But if you have to do that with like 15 people, I can't imagine what it was like for you to teach all those waiters. You know, because everybody, you know, they might have, even my cooks would have had some experience, your waiters would have had some experience, but then you have to teach them the way that you want things done, because every restaurant's different.
Only so much experience, and that's...
Yeah.
Sometimes that's worse than better. So, most stressful moment in any opening? Because I know mine.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know. I mean, I just remember... you know, enjoying the excitement of opening our first restaurant. I mean, I remember how great that was. I'll never forget standing on the line and looking out into the dining room with my sous chef, who had worked with us at Savannah, just looking out into the dining room and thinking, I've wanted to do this since I was a kid. This is our restaurant. We own this restaurant with our wonderful investors. This is, you know, I can't help but say mine. I was so excited that finally
you have to say wonderful investors, because they're betting on something, and at that moment they're betting on something that was,
who knew,
not proven.
Right. Who knew? They took a chance on us, for sure. But that was one of the greatest moments. I one of my most stressful moments. I mean, I just remember our opening party, frankly, was like, oh my God. I mean,
that
it was
more
crazy.
Stressful for me than for you.
I don't really have a stressful moment. I mean, I think overall it's just a stressful experience. But I don't really remember. Tell me yours.
Mine was at Georgia Brown's, and I've had others since then. But I recall, you know, the vice president of the company, the guy who ran it.
Yeah.
The guy who ran it for the owner of the company that we worked for in D.C. It was a Saturday night. I think it was Saturday, October 12th, 1993.
Oh, gosh.
And it was about 8 o'clock, and I was working the desk and bouncing out to the floor and working the desk. And poor Mike, who was the maitre d'hotel in the opening of that restaurant,
he
was not prepared to be behind on tables. And we were behind getting tables for reservations. Mm-hmm. And at 8 o'clock, I counted, and we had 32 tables waiting to sit down.
Oh, gosh.
And we had 36 tables in the restaurant, yeah.
Oh, boy.
So that was a lot.
That was stressful.
And Paul walking up to me and saying, you know, this hurts. We're going to pay for this. We're going to pay for this.
Oh, wow.
For the next couple of months.
Uh-oh.
And just thinking about... Well, it stuck with me. I mean, it's a
of
very
course.
Good, very good lesson from him.
Of course.
You know, the tone that things are set with in the beginning. I mean, I can't think about opening a restaurant and not think about, I made these mistakes. It's the first thing I think of.
Sure.
This is what I overlooked. This is what I messed up. It's funny. You can get...
Or misgauged
80%
or
right. Or, yeah. 85% right, 90% right. But it's humanity you're trying to predict. You're trying to predict their reaction. You're trying to predict the dynamics. It's a complicated beast, and you're doing it on not a lot of sleep.
Right, that's for sure.
And you're doing it
without
great experience, especially early on. You know,
it's a tremendous learning experience and a quick curve.
One that I do not wish on my children.
No, right. I'm sure.
I know just enough about it to know that I like it a lot. You know me, I get more excited about those times than any other.
Yes, you do. You love it. You thrive on it, for sure. And it is very exciting.
I like
but it
the
is
chaos.
One of the hardest things you can do professionally is opening for in our profession is opening a restaurant.
You know what's one of the hardest things you're going to have to do?
The chef challenge.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
Here you go. Read them and weep.
Okay. Ground turkey, mozzarella de buffalo, pickled peppers, prosciutto di Parma. Is there something I need to know here?
No.
Baby artichokes, cannellini beans, fresh basil, mint.
It's all the stuff that popped
breast,
in my mind.
Jalapeno peppers. It's quite the list. Polenta.
You're welcome.
All dairy, onions of all sorts, garlic, etc., extra virgin olive oil, eggs, panko, which is breadcrumb, duck bacon. Well, that's fun. Carrots. I like duck bacon.
Me too.
Ground turkey. Let's see. Well, I'm going to do an antipasto plate with the prosciutto, the baby artichokes, what's fun with baby artichokes and the basil. And actually, I'm going to add the chicken breast to that. Yeah, I'm going to grill the chicken breasts, let them cool down a little bit, and slice them thin and hit them with a little bit of extra virgin olive oil and the mint and salt and pepper and have that laid out on the platter. I'll cook the cannellini beans with the jalapeno peppers to give it a little spice, reserve a few of those jalapenos. Once the cannellinis are nice and tender, toss them with a little bit of the chopped jalapeno and extra virgin olive oil and thinly slice, rub them with, do I have any acid, Tony? Can I do a little lime?
Oh, sure.
So a little bit of acid on the artichoke, otherwise you're going to discolor and you need the acid for flavor.
Absolutely.
A little salt and pepper, and then have slices of the prosciutto. So, and the pickled peppers can also be a garnish on the side. Slices of the buffalo mozzarella, that sounds like a whole lot of fun to me. The ground turkey, and okay, so what's going to happen is that was lunch. And
the antipasti was lunch?
Yeah, the antipasta was lunch. For breakfast, I'm making ground turkey.
If that was lunch, I should have given you bread to go with it.
Ground turkey. I'll make little patties with it, basically. So I'll season it with a little bit of salt and pepper. And
wait, you're going to make turkey burgers?
I am. And you have a little bit of panko there, so I can, and eggs. So I'll break one egg for 1 pound of the ground turkey meat and mix it in. Do like a tablespoon of the panko. It just helps to tighten it up a little bit and give it good texture. I find that when you make something like this, the more you work it, the better it is. So if you really kind of work that ground turkey with a little bit of salt and pepper and the egg and the panko.
By working it.
Working it like palmette, almost like you're making bread. Just keep hitting it on the work table with your hand.
Kneading it with all the seasonings
it a little bit.
And all that business.
Right. And then form it into little patties. And that with a little bit of duck bacon sliced on top, man. So sear the little turkey burgers and thinly slice the duck bacon on top. I think I reserved a little bit of that jalapeno, so I'm going to make a little salad with the carrots and jalapeno. And I used everything.
You didn't use any dairy, did you?
Oh, eggs. No, I didn't. But you know what I was thinking? What I really wanted to do was fry an egg and put it on top of that turkey burger. That's what I'm going to do. So that's the breakfast part.
So
it's a turkey burger with
a
duck bacon.
Burger.
Mm-hmm. And then forget those carrots. Those carrots can go back on the antipasta platter. Yeah, breakfast and lunch. Two meals in one. Thanks, Tony. Yeah.
Still need bread for both.
Okay, so here's your situation.
And Luke, our producer, is clapping because he's a fan of turkey burgers.
All right,
apparently.
There you go. All right, so Tony's situation is he has a smaller list than I normally give him.
Oh, yeah.
And which I know he likes. And the situation is that's...
You usually give me a crazy list.
Uh-huh. So someone brings scallops over to your house. You're having friends over. And they're like, hey, I brought these scallops. And that's all they bring. So all the other stuff is all you have in your refrigerator to work with. Chef's challenge.
I have, well, in my refrigerator, I have things like
cheese
sticks.
I don't care what's in your refrigerator.
Because I have a four-year-old. All right. Not that you'd have cheese sticks and scallops.
Uh-huh.
Well, I'd much rather have scallops seared in a pan than anything else.
Me too.
You gave me lemon, caper, and butter.
Yeah, I gave you some
and parsley.
Obvious.
So it's all pretty darn easy.
Fun stuff.
Yeah, pretty darn easy to make a sauce with that. You give me white wine. I can make a... God, you're not using dairy in yours, and I'm going to make a beurre blanc in mine. It's like a solar eclipse.
Hey, it's good.
So make a beurre blanc with the lemon and the capers and the parsley using the white wine and plenty of butter for the scallops. And then what have I got to fool with? Carrots and potatoes. Let's have some fun with those guys. So the carrots, I'm going to give them I'm gonna hope that I have things in the pantry. I can give them a quick. I don't.
No, that's all you have.
I don't. Okay.
That's all the food you have in the house.
Well, I'm gonna have to cook the carrots and the potatoes in the butter. I'll boil the potatoes a while first. Skin them, boil them, let them cool down a little bit. Mash them, and just do it like a rough mash with the butter, salt, pepper. Really didn't give me much to play with. Scallops around that, butter sauce around that. The carrots, sliced very, very thin. Do I have oil?
Yes.
Okay. Can I fry them?
You can have oil.
I want to fry those thin carrots and garnish the scallops with little crispy carrots and cut them the long way so you get kind of like, you know, wiggly pieces, almost like ribbons.
Wiggly.
Yeah. So you get a little crunch with your scallops and your...
Okay, sounds good.
And all the butter business.
There you go.
Okay.
Easy chef's challenge. All right, Tony. So what are we going to drink with these fun chef's challenges? I can't wait to hear.
I want to see you eat a turkey burger first.
I would love to eat a turkey burger. I don't have anything against turkey burgers.
All right. Yeah, a nice fat bottle of Côte de Rhône Village.
Hey, I like ground meat.
Know, that's go ahead. Not super expensive, tons of flavor.
So you said what?
You could also drink a Red Zinfandel with it.
You said
With your turkey burger, your breakfast turkey burger.
What are we drinking for breakfast?
Exactly.
Prosecco.
No, it will never carry it off. You get too much. There's too much flavor there. You need red wine. You need something kind of gutsy and fruity. And a Côte de Rhône Village, a Zinfandel.
That sounds like fun. Okay.
Maybe
a specific Côte de Rhône Village.
I'd look for one of the 15s. The vintage is really, really good.
Okay.
15s. So 14 solid, but 15 is really, really good.
That's exciting. Good. Because those are fairly priced wines, right?
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah. Good. Even with the euro rising a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. And for your chef challenge?
For the
scallop.
Very simple scallop dish.
The very simple scallop.
The elegant, simple scallop dish.
With a little potato and carrot.
I mean, scallops want Chardonnay. Scallops are kind of inherently sweet. They have that kind of corny flavor.
Corny.
Exactly.
That's what they taught us in culinary school. They said that when you open, like if you buy shucked scallops, that when you open the bucket, it should smell like fresh corn. I will never forget being told that. Those are the things that, God, those lessons are so fun.
Yeah, but North Coast Chardonnay.
Okay.
Or honestly, if I want to spoil a little bit, Mount Eden Chardonnay from the Santa Cruz Mountains, that estate Chardonnay is always terrific. And ages pretty well, too. You could drink a 2007, 8, 9, 10. Be beautiful with it right now.
Okay. Sounds good.
That's all we get to drink with breakfast and lunch. If you want to reach us on social media.
You can follow me on Twitter as Chef Cindy Wolf or on Instagram as Chef Wolf.
On Instagram, I'm the real Tony Foreman.
That always makes me laugh.
Well, that's the idea. If you want to download this or any other podcast, go to the WYPR website, wypr.org. Look for the Foreman Wolf page. And download all the episodes that you'd like to hear and rehear from our historic program.
Historic.
Oh, and if you want to reach us via email, email us foremanwolf@wypr.org with comments, questions. People have been great about sending us recipes and ideas. So please send them along, foremanwolf@wypr.org. Anyway, thanks for listening.
Happy Sunday.